Unlock big savings and add style and security to your home with high-quality Schlage door locks from Menards. Whether you're looking for a traditional interior lock or a Wi-Fi-compatible electronic lock, Menards has you covered. With more than 200 options of Schlage door locks in stock, save big on all door locks. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Hey there, this is Brian Grinn, author, health coach, and podcast host, and you're listening to the Road to Rediscovery podcast with Aubrey Johnson. Enjoy another great episode and have a great day.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on The Road to Rediscovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, pay it forward and uplift others who are struggling through dark times. I'm happy to share that the official Road to Rediscovery stand store is now officially open. That's right, inspired by this podcast and the insights from many amazing guests, we have all sorts of resources targeting your personal growth, from free e-guides to e-books, to the full-blown Rediscovery Roadmap digital course. Get on the road to overcoming adversities and realizing your true potential by visiting us at stan.store/road to rediscovery. That's stan.store/road2rediscovery. And we are always, always so, so grateful for your listenership. Okay, my special guest is the CEO and the president of Texas State Optical, or TSO. Over the past 20 years, he has grown TSO into one of the top 10 retail optical organizations in the U.S., providing eye care for more Texas families than any other provider. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Mr. John D. Marvin. John, how are you? It's so great to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here, Aubrey. I've been looking forward to this. I love your show, and I love the approach you take to helping people grow personally and reach their potential. That's what I'm all about. I do need to say that since we talked last, there's an update, and that is I have resigned from Texas State Optical.
Is that
after
right?
25 years, I resigned in May 1st.
Yeah.
And my last day was June 30th. So it doesn't take away from the years of time that I spent there, actually a total of about 33 years altogether. But 25 as the president of the company, and I'm excited about what's going on for myself in the future and new chapters.
Absolutely. I was just about to say that, John. I mean, it's, one chapter closes, another chapter opens.
That's right.
And you know what? I mean, we never get too old to reinvest in ourselves. We never get too old to reinvent ourselves or redefine ourselves. You know, we're not just defined by one part of our lives or one chapter, right? It's sure. It's a blend of so many things, and the insights that you've gained and the insights that you've imparted over your 33 plus years, in this organization and in eye care, that's a legacy. It's a true legacy in which the people who have learned and studied under, your mentorship will continue to follow and impart on people that are coming up, younger than them. So I believe congratulations are in order, John. And I'm excited for you as well as the next chapter. And I am equally thankful for you clarifying and sharing this for the listeners, in terms of where you are today. So this is great, John. And I would love if you could kind of help us unpack by giving us a glimpse, into the early years of your journey that inspired you to pursue eye care.
Well, okay, that'd be great. I think it's probably important to understand that I grew up in a family practice, private family practice culture and household. My dad is a medical doctor, a family physician, and all since I have any memory at all, he's had his own practice.
Yep.
And I grew up in a small town in western Kansas. And so he was one of two doctors in the town. They were partners with each other. And my mother was the office manager. And so I kind of understand that small business, small private practice, like I said, culture. And it was always something I thought was of great value.
Yeah.
To the patients, to the community. Extremely rewarding as a provider. My father loved what he did, loved the people he did it with. And but I knew that I wasn't called to be a doctor, and I do believe that's a calling. So when I went to school, I decided that I would go into business and specifically study marketing. And I came out of school. I found myself working in the pharmaceutical industry first, and then made the jump to medical practice, where I was an administrator of a large surgical practice in Wichita, Kansas. And it was through that that I met another similar type practice in Houston and moved to and my family to Houston, Texas in 1989, where I still live. And it was through that medical practice that I was first introduced to Texas State Optical. And it was through a consumer research study, because that was largely most of my role in this practice, as well as I left there and started my own kind of management, marketing management boutique business, where I would do consumer research for different businesses. And one of them that I got hired by was Texas State Optical. I did a 2-year study, a couple of thousand interviews, a number of focus groups. And it was through that that I became intimately familiar with their business, their consumers, their customers, and ended up being retained by the franchisees to help them form a franchise association. And that led to an interest on their part to buy the company in the late 90s. They asked me to help them negotiate the acquisition. And I did. And about 2/3 of the way through that, they said, if we're successful, would you be interested in coming on as the new president? And I said, I would. And then I spent the next 25 years in that position. So, and it was a great opportunity. It was a fixer-upper.
Yeah.
When I first became president, we had a small but an older organization because it had not it was losing its relevance. TSO was founded in 1936.
Oh, wow.
So next year it'll be 90 years old.
Yeah.
And it, but it had, like many businesses, if you aren't constantly reimagining and adjusting to market changes, then you can lose your relevance. And we, it was on the verge of that in the late 90s. And so I saw this as a tremendous opportunity to like I said, it was a great fixer-upper. And we started opening up new practices. We opened about 83 new practices, and brought the average age from the upper 50s down to the low 40s. And just by bringing in young optometrists and that would want to own their own practice. And so it was great. But after a number of years, marketplace conditions change and opportunities change, and I just saw a different opportunity for me to go ahead and step down after that long of a run and begin the next chapter. So that's kind of how I'm got to where I am today, Aubrey.
That's wonderful, John. And yeah, wonderful, a wonderful run it has been. I am sure without a doubt. And I love what you said earlier about, you know, with your father's practice as a doctor in West Kansas. I mean, we have, like small town feel. You have, you know, your queue of customers, your queue of patients. Everyone knows you. You're the guy in the town for general practice, for, you know, healing people, helping people feel better. And it's an incredible service to, you know, help sustain the health of others in that community. And that's a great, great feel. I mean, and to me, it just strengthens the community overall. Realizing what your path was going to be at a certain point when you're in college and everything, you know, knowing that it was a different path. And it's quite interesting that you say, you know, that it can be a calling when you realize you're not going to do something. I mean, usually a calling is associated with this is your calling to do this or to do that. But it also may be your calling to not do a certain thing.
Yeah, I knew that. Excuse me, I'm going to adjust this here because I'm getting some. There we go. Better lighting there. Sorry about that. I knew that I didn't have the same kind of passion for patient care that my father had.
Right.
First of all, it could have been because he set a pretty high bar, and I just didn't feel that that was something. Certainly over the years, I've run into several family physicians that didn't come close to that bar. So yeah. I suppose I might have been able to do it, but I always felt it was really important. And he had always talked to me about do something you're passionate about, something you do feel called to do.
Right.
And I just was fascinated by the consumer behavior aspects of marketing. Mm-hmm. And so that really drew me in. Was one of those things that I knew that I could be passionate about, even if I didn't get paid for it. You know, I could just, it was something that I really, really enjoyed understanding and using and helping a business understand it, how to move products or services into the hands of their customers. And so that's kind of what drew me that way.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, John. And in the field of marketing, as you know, and being fascinated with consumer behavior and so forth, it sounds like you have you've taken leadership to another level, being more than just help guide people and make recommendations and be there to support, you know, teams and so forth, but also to be, as they say, have your ear on the ground, right? Your thumb on the pulse of the current condition, right? The climate. One thing that's consistent in this world is change. And with change, you know, we're going to have to find ways to adapt, find ways to adjust. I mean, as an organization, as a team, you know, with the peaks and valleys, the ebbs and flows of just how the world is run. Things happen in this world, you know. It could be on a local scale, on a regional scale, on a national scale, on a global scale, right? So, and being cognizant of that change happening is, to me, it's part of an attribute of an effective leader. And so the next few questions I wanted to ask you is regarding the mindset of a leader, okay, and as well as effective leadership and virtues from leadership that can help and benefit us in our personal lives, if that's okay.
Sure.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So John, my first question is kind of like a point blank question. Okay. And I would love your insight on this. It's an age old question. I'm sure you've been asked this before, but just want to know your thoughts. Okay. Mm-hmm. Are leaders naturally born or raised or both?
I believe leadership has to be, it's intention. It's a set of skills that can be learned, and it has to be, the learning has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that leaders are born. Right. I don't think anybody's born a leader. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think that you're raised a leader, other than you might have influences as you grow up that shape your mindset.
Right.
That open your, the right mindset will enable you to learn the skills. If you have a mentality that I'm no good in this, or I'm no good with people, or I'm no good with that, You know, then it limits what you're willing to apply yourself to.
Right.
And if you have a mindset that's open, that says I can do anything I want to do, mm-hmm. I just have to learn the skills necessary to do it.
Right.
Then that is the type of mindset that's necessary to develop into a influential leader. And I'm a student of John Maxwell, mm-hmm. and John Maxwell defines leadership as influence.
Yes.
And I subscribe to that. And so you've got to develop the skills that would enable you to be influential, and influential in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. But one of them is helping others open up to their potential. And that's why I said I was looking forward to being here with you, because based on what I can tell, that's kind of what your podcast and your mission is to helping people discover kind of their own potential and how to develop personally and grow personally. And all of that is critical to developing leadership skills. And so that was just something that I decided years ago when I was first introduced to John Maxwell, mm-hmm. And started reading some of his material, which opened up. It was like opening a door to a shopping mall where I was opening up to go to one store, and I opened it up and I found 50 stores. And so I began to learn from others, and I created this whole group of what I call my mentors that I learned from. Some of them haven't been alive in 100 years, but mm-hmm. their writings are such that they were mentors to me.
Sure.
And so by learning that, it was a decision that I made that I was going to intentionally become an influential leader. And I wasn't thinking of it nationally, globally, even citywide. I was thinking about it in terms of my sphere, my family, my community, my company, mm-hmm. and the people that I had the privilege of working with. Mm-hmm. I was going to be a positive influence in those people's lives and practice that art of leadership.
Yes. Yes. No, that makes sense. And it's another perspective too that makes it more reasonable, more manageable, instead of feeling overwhelmed by going on a global scale of trying to be an effective leader, just dealing with your world, right? Your sphere, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. Makes it more practical, more manageable, and everything. So that makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate that clarification, John. In fact, I think you even touched on one of my next questions, which was, you know, some of the perspective differences that someone who is leader oriented would have versus someone who's not. I heard you say that, you know, you have to have the open mind and be objective enough to believe you can, and you can be a leader. You can take on these responsibilities. All you have to do is learn these skills versus someone who doesn't believe they could, you know. So that's an example, I guess, of a perspective, a difference in perspective between someone who's leadership oriented and someone who may not be as leadership oriented. So I want to thank you for that as well. Now, strange question, but have you seen the movie? This is from, I guess, the mid to late 80s with Michael Douglas, called Wall Street.
Yes, of course. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, very good movie. And and I can't remember every single scene or you know, line from the movie, but it looks like Michael Douglas's character, from the outside, he appeared to be a man of perfectionism and to be a perfectionist. And so I want to ask you, you know, what are your thoughts on some leaders out there who consider themselves as perfectionists and I don't know, maybe even more so expect perfectionism, you know, from their teams? I mean, is this is this something reasonable, or you know, when a leader leads with the concept of perfection, what's your thoughts on that?
Interesting question, Aubrey, and interesting for a couple of ways. One, just in the fact that it is interesting, but just the other night, referencing another movie, I watched a documentary on Martha Stewart.
Oh, yeah.
And the documentary, the premise of it was that she was a perfectionist, or she is a perfectionist. She's still alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And we weren't talking about a character, Gordon Gekko, as in the Wall Street movie.
Right.
We're talking about Martha.
A real
and a real person. It forced me to kind of think about that as I was reacting to her person in that movie. And I came to believe, and I do believe this, that perfectionism comes from a core of insecurity in one's sense of value of themselves. And the reason I say that is this pursuit of getting things absolutely perfect is a quest for approval and acceptance.
Mm.
And it comes from feeling insecure, inadequate. I'm not good enough. So I have to be perfect in this so that you will consider me acceptable.
Mm.
And I have to demand that out of others, because if you work for me, then you become an extension of me and my value and my worth. Mm. And so it's not enough that I have to be perfect. I have to have everyone around me perfect as well, because that is an extension of me. And as I watched that documentary, I went through a number of emotions, but certainly one of them was I felt very sad for her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was this unquenchable passion and desire that she had for acceptance.
Mm.
And I hate to characterize someone purely from one documentary that I watched on Netflix, but
if
you want to watch an interesting documentary, that certainly is one. It's called Martha.
Yeah.
But assuming it's true to a large extent, she lives her whole life wanting to be accepted by people.
I see.
And it gave some suggestions as to why that was, that were based in her childhood with her father and her mother and her family life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really, there's a difference between working to be good at something, working to be excellent at something, and being a perfectionist. Excellence is something that is an unending pursuit of performing at your own best, not so that you can get accepted or be accepted, but because you want to live up to your own standards of doing as good a job as you can. Speaking of mentors, Napoleon Hill is a mentor of mine. I'm a student of Napoleon Hill. And he talks about, I was just reading this afternoon a little bit, where he talks about going the extra mile. There's a principle he has of always delivering more than for which you're getting compensated.
Mm.
And that's just a belief in yourself that I'm here to provide value to Aubrey. And so by doing everything I possibly can to provide as much value as I possibly can, that's different than being a perfectionist.
Yes, it is.
I mean, there's just a difference. One is kind of a born out of insecurity, and the other one is a passion for other people. And I think that marks the big difference.
Yeah, I completely agree, John. And I really love the way you articulated the association of perfectionism to acceptance, right? It could be articulated anyway, whether we use an example of a documentary or not, but it clearly is relatable to anyone who listens. When you explain that association of perfectionism and acceptance, and like you said, if a CEO's team or teams is an extension of him or herself, And they themselves are perfectionists. They pursue perfection. They expect the same of their teams to pursue perfection as their extension. In my opinion, that can only lead to a reduction in engagement among the workforce. Okay. And so that engagement goes down. Another thing that is a little more practical that can truly and negatively impact engagement is, as we all know, change. And so from a change management perspective, there are things that leaders must be privy to help support their teams in navigating through that change cycle, whatever the change may be, you know, within an organization. So my question to you, John, is how can leadership support the workforce through a change cycle in a sufficient time while sustaining the business, okay, to regain that engagement from the workforce?
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned is to have a high performing team, and every president or CEO, regardless of whether you're president of a small company with 25 or 30 employees or
right.
250 to 300 employees, mm-hmm. we all end up working with a small circle. I referred to them as my leadership team.
Yes.
You have to break it down. And so to have the highest performing leadership team, I have to know those people. You know, I've always admired the college football coach that helps to mold and shape young men and women that go on to achieve great things in their sport, but also many times and often go on to achieve great things in the workplace or in business world afterwards. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that coach has to do is he has to get into the living room of that young recruit. He has to meet mom or mom and dad. He has to get to know the brothers and the sisters.
That's right.
The athlete. And by doing so, he learns, she learns, how to best provide that young athlete the type of guidance they need. Because if I've got a leadership team of three or four people, they're all different.
They
respond to different motivations and yep. incentives. And if I don't take the time to get to know them, I'm not talking about being their best friend.
No.
I'm talking about spending time learning what their dreams are. Why do they like this job?
Yeah.
What is it they want out of this job?
Right.
If all they want is I want to put in my 3 to 5 so that I can use this to get a better job, I get it. That's fine.
Yeah.
A lot of people do that. Mm-hmm. And so it would behoove me if during that 3 to 5 that I've got that person, I want to get the most value I can, then I want to understand what their motivation is to be there and help them get the best 3 to 5 so that when they go out and move into a different position, they know I've helped them. And yeah. they don't end up with this, well, I'm here to take advantage of John and John's taking advantage of me. Instead, it's John and I are working on the same plan together. And I understand what he needs for the next 3 to 5. And he understands what I want in years 6 through 10. But I wouldn't know that unless I take the time to just break it down and say, what do you want to get out of this? Because I'll help you get everything you want out of this.
Yeah.
And obviously they want a paycheck. They've got families.
Yep.
But that's also very important. I mean, you've got to understand that motivation as well. And so I think that one of the ways that you get the most out of your team and you have the greatest influence in your leadership on that team is you take the time to listen to them, invest in them, and understand them, and then help them accomplish. That college coach knows that I'm only going to have you maybe 5 years at the most.
Right.
So let's get the most out of it for both of us. So that when you're done here, you're on to bigger and better things. And I've always kind of taken that approach with people that work for me
yeah.
in the company as well.
Yeah, no, that truly resonates with me, John. I'm hearing two things here. Number one, you know, with leaders having and should, you know, take those steps to learn about their behaviors, what motivates them, you know, their, you know, what elements of their family or what dynamics do they have that may be different from other players, other students. And you know, what's their end goal, right? What's the end game for them? And trying to understand those things so that, so that number one, it's, you're not insensitive to that. And it, and it doesn't seem so, transactional, right? We don't want it to be transactional. We want this to be an opportunity to grow and flourish to where both sides benefit, the coach and the player. And
that's right.
Yeah. And then there's a sense of servant leadership in which you follow as an effective leader to support mm-hmm. and help that person get what they're looking for out of this. You know, as they're adding value, they're getting value back with your support and getting them where they want to be, wherever that end game is. And so, you know, it may be a long-term transaction, but it's not transactional from an insensitive standpoint, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, no, and there's a third stakeholder in all of this. There's the employee.
Yes.
There is myself. And then there's the team. There's the company.
Yes. Yes.
And so all three have to get value out of this relationship. And 100%. And it is a relationship, mm-hmm. hopefully a long-term relationship. And part of what I really make an effort to do is to sit with someone and go, basically, what is it going to take for me to keep you here a long time?
Right.
Because the longer you're in this position with this company or with this company, you're going to become of more value to yourself,
yes,
to me, and yes. to the company.
Yes.
And so what is it that I'm going to need to do to provide you with whatever incentives, whether they be money, but rarely is it just money.
Right.
It's usually opportunity, yep. and it's usually opportunity to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after spending 10 years with you, John, I want to be better at what I'm doing and better in my area of responsibilities
yeah.
than I was when I started.
Yes.
And I want you to help me develop that capability. And so, and then the other thing, that things change.
Yeah.
So you can sit down in January and have this good old fashioned talk. And then by October, things could be different.
Sure.
So you've got to constantly keep that relationship going, and yes. it can't be done in just, okay, we're going to meet once a month for 30 minutes and we'll talk. No, it's got to be a every day, every week, every yes. month yes. touch. And how are you doing?
Right.
Everything okay? I get to know people well enough. I can tell when they're out of rhythm, you know, something's
yes.
not right. So tell me right. what's going on.
Yes. And yes.
That type of relationship is critical to have a high performing team. And it is not difficult to do, but it has to be intentional.
Yes.
And if it's not intentional, it'll never get done. And certainly part of it is recognizing, being my own self-aware, the fact that I'm not real perfect at any of this. I'm just me.
Yeah.
And you know, and letting them see a little bit of that vulnerability so they recognize that I'm not authoritarian at all. Mm-hmm. in my style or approach to them,
mm-hmm.
but I'm more coach. I'm like a coach.
Gotcha.
And all I ask of them is to be coachable.
Right. No. And that's not much to ask. I mean, in the role that you're playing as a coach, mm-hmm. And you know, and a lot of workers, a lot of students, mm-hmm. a lot of athletes, you know, they want to be coached because they want to grow, to your point earlier,
sure.
you know,
sure.
and John, I have been really enjoying this part of our conversation has involved a journey from talking about and sharing insights on disengagement, such as perfection and dealing with change.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've talked about engagement, right, in ways to help connect with a worker, help connect with a student or an athlete and understand what makes them tick, and asking them, you know, showing them your vulnerability and mm-hmm. how can I support you? Tell me how I can support you better in where you want to go, you know, since you've been here this length of time. So, and it shows that you're human, right? You're not sitting on an ivory tower barking commands. You're right there in the trench with them saying, yeah, we're going to get through this together. And that's critically important, as you said, to establishing these relationships and being intentional. One thing I had to say there, yeah, being intentional. I think workers see and feel that, okay, based on your authenticity, and it has to be in your heart in order to be truly intentional. If it's taken at face value and just trying to check the boxes, don't you think workers or students or athletes would kind of see through that in a leader?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing that we tell ourselves mm-hmm. is that we can fake it till we make it.
Yeah.
You've probably heard that.
Yes.
And I'm a believer that people can smell inauthenticity a mile away.
Oh, sure. For sure.
Yeah.
And for sure. So
if you're not comfortable enough with yourself to be authentic, mm-hmm. then that's your first job, is to get comfortable with yourself so you can be authentic. Otherwise, you're not going to go very far. You're not going to have a happy marriage. You're not going to be a good parent. You can't be a good teacher in the classroom.
No.
You got to be yourself. You've got to be authentic. The idea of trying to be something you're not because you believe everyone expects it is a perspective of failure. It just won't deliver.
No, it won't deliver. And having that authenticity, you know, to be intentional, definitely has to be there. And for us to kind of tie a bow here on engagement, right? And one thing you mentioned earlier, right? If you're not being intentional and you're not authentic, it's going to kind of have an impact on every facet of your life, right? You know, mm-hmm. you can't really be an effective partner or spouse or parent or worker, you know, whether it's a professional life or personal life. I wanted to ask you, at least in the company that I work in, at least, you know, we are, we champion, instead of perfectionism, one of the phrases we say is never best, only better, right? So with continuous improvement,
yeah, absolutely.
We always want to Kaizen, we want to grow, we look for ways to continuously improve. Problems are never a really, really bad thing. It's often given a negative connotation when really it's an opportunity to improve a process or something that can get us a little better than we were before. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, standardizing those processes. And so with continuous improvement, being more practical, more reasonable, more attainable for teams to reach versus mm-hmm. perfectionism, what are some of the virtues from practicing continuous improvement that workers can learn and embrace in the job, in the workplace, that they can actually carry with them to improve facets of their personal life?
Well, I think an understanding of continual learning, being a student for life, is something that I believe you have to be awakened to.
Yeah.
I was fortunate in the fact that I had a sophomore high school English teacher that helped me see the virtues and the value of continuous learning.
Yes.
And gave me a real passion for reading because of what it opened up in terms of an opportunity to learn. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've got a book on my bookshelf titled Kaizen by the Japanese professor
Oh, really?
That wrote one of the kind of manuals on the concept in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, when Japan was held up as kind of the model of continual improvement or quality management.
Right, right.
And I was fortunate enough to go through a whole series of educational courses in that concept. And had I not had that sophomore English teacher not shown me the beauty and the empower and importance of reading and what it and kind of introduced me to that continual learning.
Yeah.
Then I probably wouldn't have taken as much from that process as I did. And I became not just a student of that, but a believer in continual improvement.
Yes.
And getting all the stakeholders around the table to review the process, improve the process, and turn it into a reliable method.
Yes.
And then continually challenging that method every day. How can we make this better?
100%.
And it's a culture and it's a belief system that if it's implemented in the workplace, then people cannot help but adapt it for a life system, their own life belief system. And so by understanding that, then they take it home. And instead of arguing constantly with a spouse, they'll begin to wonder, how can I be better so that our marriage is better?
Yes.
How can I be better so that my children are better?
Yes.
How can I be better so that my company is better?
Yes.
And knowing and recognizing that organizations, relationships, marriages, households are simply a collection of people. Mm-hmm. And the only person I got control over is myself. That's it.
That's right.
So if I try to fix everybody else in the organization, mm-hmm. but I don't start with myself, then all I'm going to do is have a short time in whatever that organization is, including my marriage.
Yeah.
If I spend all my time trying to fix my wife,
mm-hmm.
then I'm not going to have a wife very long, right?
No.
But if I spend my time fixing me,
yes,
I'll probably be amazed at what a wonderful wife I have. You know?
So, oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, and mm-hmm. this is less finger pointing, more accountability.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. And that's probably the biggest value that employees and team members can benefit from as a result of a culture of continual improvement, is understanding that starts with them.
Yes. Yes. And that's huge. And that's part of the importance of building a culture in a workplace of continuous improvement.
Absolutely.
And getting that buy-in, right? Getting the buy-in from them. Then it shows in their work, it shows in their behavior, it shows in how they mm-hmm. interact with each other. And to me, there's a true element of humility that's involved with that type of mindset as well. So,
it requires, Aubrey, that I go back to that conversation that I said, I set people down and I want to understand, what do you want to get out of this?
Yeah.
Part of that is understanding, what do you want to become really good at?
Yes.
And what area of your life, it doesn't matter. Just pick anything you want. If it's, John, I've always wanted to be a better cook. All right. But let's talk about it, because it becomes kind of an archetype and role model
for yeah.
how you improve yourself.
Yes.
And so if you can do what you need to do to be a better cook or be a good cook, then you begin to learn the skills necessary to be really good in other areas of your life.
Absolutely.
And so a part of our performance review is requiring people to have a personal growth plan for themselves.
Yes.
Now, I don't dictate what it is, but they have to sit down and reflect on what it is they want to improve in.
Right.
And then I will help them. And if it means buying them a book, I'll buy them a book. If it means going to a course, we'll go to a course.
Yes.
I'll do whatever is necessary to support them in their own personal growth. And when they can see that the person they work for is really interested in helping them become a better person, mm-hmm. with more skills, then they value that, and it forms the foundation of a relationship that has trust in it. And if you don't have trust, you're not going to get anything done.
No, you surely aren't. And there's a class that I teach along with some of my colleagues. It's called The Speed of Trust. And so
Stephen Covey.
Covey, yeah. And so, you know, it does talk about, you know, companies, they can actually run slow or even stall when there isn't the appropriate trust amongst the leaders and the team members, you know, that it should be, right? So it truly spells that out for sure. And in that example you just gave there, again, John, your flashes of servant leadership is shining through you. I can see it like an aura. The servant leadership and how you want to support them in their growth. You gave the first example as the coach to the recruit. You gave this example here as the leader to the team member, and for you to so eloquently articulate these examples has got to come genuinely from your leadership style. So, John, this has been an absolutely lovely conversation, sir. And I would love to ask you, for the listeners' benefit, how can they connect with you? How can they learn more about the great work that you're doing when it comes to leadership?
Well, Aubrey, as I mentioned in the kind of the outset, I left Texas State Optical and I'm no longer at that company. So I'm in the process of forming, putting up the company that I have had in the back of my mind for a while and kind of understood that I believe this is the calling, this next chapter. For right now, the best place to connect with me is in LinkedIn.
Okay.
You just look up my name, John D. Marvin. I use my middle initial.
Yep.
For on LinkedIn, then you'll find me and send me a note. I'd be happy to either correspond with you via that way. I'll give you my email at that point. Mm-hmm. And if it's something you're interested in, I'll even get on a phone call with somebody and we'll just talk. We'll just share experiences. I'll learn. Hopefully I can be of value. I'd be happy to help as many people in your audience as I could. But that's kind of the best way to start with is find me there.
Okay, I tell you what, we're going to go ahead and start with that, John. We're going to have your LinkedIn URL and link in the episode mm-hmm. show notes so the okay. listeners can connect with you on LinkedIn. I'm going to connect with you on LinkedIn, and my listener base and my listenership, we're going to watch as you plant this seed in your next chapter, okay, see what blossoms, what grows, what flourishes. Right. Because I know there'll be an abundance of other connection opportunities in what you put together for listeners and people looking for ways to improve themselves, to grow and to become effective leaders. So, John, we'll have that in the episode show notes. They'll click that, connect with you while listening to this wonderful conversation. John D. Marvin, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, sharing your insights. I genuinely hope we can stay in touch and bring you on the show in the future once you get this stood up.
I would love that, Aubrey. Really appreciate it. And like I said, I just was so impressed with the commitment of the whole purpose of the podcast. And I look forward to following you and watching your success too, because I'm confident that will continue to grow.
I truly appreciate your thoughtfulness, John. I really do. And yes, I'm all about community, right? I play a part in a community and to help grow a community. So I think we're all in this together. I think we only become stronger when we come together. So John, thank you once again for coming on the show, sir. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And hey, look, you may feel like this way at times, but in our daily struggles and adversities, you're never alone. And hope is always around the corner. I humbly ask that you please share this show with someone you know, someone you love, who needs motivation, inspiration, and support. And you know, when it all comes down to it, we're all just roadies on this journey of life. But it sure feels good having you on the road with me. Thanks again for listening. We'll chat again soon.
We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Road to Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadsrediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have.